as an opportunity to stand back and ask ourselves what we mean when we talk about intelligence. And I guess there are a couple of reasons to think about this. We operate now in a cultural moment where there are sort of hyped up versions of what we mean when we talk about intelligence. And obviously we're all here because of one of those versions, which is, of course, machine intelligence and AI. And I think it's incumbent on us to ask ourselves what we're actually dealing with when we're talking about machines that operate in some realm of, if you like, artificial intelligence. The other probably more practical reason is, of course, if we get the answer to this wrong, people won't use the things that you build. And there are numerous reasons, numerous examples that we see all over the place of intelligence being embedded in various software and hardware devices that we use, and people just switching it off. And really, that's a problem that I feel like we face in Microsoft and in the research group that I work in, is confronting AI and thinking, when will people actually want to use something that introduces some kind of interpretation? And I think that's a genuine question that we need to ask ourselves. So Rebecca had three principles. I'm going to talk about three stories, three, if you like, versions, if you will, of what I see to be intelligence, or what I will go on to talk about, capability or capacity in practice. And this idea of capability is really important to me. What I feel like we're dealing with when we talk about intelligence is how the world makes us capable, how things in the world, how what we do in the world enables us to be capable agents, capable actors. And what I hope to talk about through my three stories is how people are being made capable in practice. So my first story is about, and obviously there are different ways in which we might talk about these examples, but I want to talk about vision in this case. And I'm going to talk about some field work that I've done with a number of people in my group around interventional radiology. And some of you may know interventional radiology is a new form of radiology in which, thanks to various things like keyhole surgery and new forms of instruments that allow cameras to be placed in bodies, surgeons can now combine the scanning of the body with surgery. So prior to this, most of the scanning would happen pre-surgery, and surgeons would look through the imagery and then operate on the body. What you'll see in this video, I think it's a 2-minute video or 3-minute video, is a surgeon directing a radiologist to continually update an x-ray. And later on, I don't think it's in this video, they go and look at these MRI scans that are on the LCD panels in the back of the room. What I want you to pay attention to is how the surgeon is getting to see the body, if you will. How vision is, if you will, is enacted in practice. And I'll talk through this in a bit more detail, but let's watch the video. Recognizing scans of the body. but what's interesting to me is that the way in which the person starts to understand the body, the way in which the person starts to piece together the idea of what comes into the body isn't through the images alone, through the activities that he's involved in and through the collaboration with other people in the surgery. It's through that very tactile sense of inserting a cable into a body and feeling it not respond in the way he's expected. So in this case, what the surgeon's doing is he's doing an operation to fuse two vertebrae together that have, because of an injury the patient's been subjected to. And he's inserting a wire into one of the vertebrae to create a thread that he will then tap some screws, so then you can join these two vertebrae together through some screws. But what he's finding is, again, through this tactile sensation of the wire not gripping into the bone, the bone is in fact is soft, softer than he would have expected. And what they go on to do, as I've said, is go back to these pre-op scans and look at them again and think, is there some suggestion here that the bone might be soft? And it turns out that it is, and that in fact, unfortunately, the patient has a cancer. But it's only through those activities, through the sequence of activities and the sensation of the wire in the bone, through the collaboration with these people in surgery, through looking again at the sequence of x-rays and then at the pre-op scans, that that discovery was made. It wasn't made by looking at the pre-op scans by themselves. And this is what I mean about being made capable, as it were. The surgeon here is being made capable through this interactional sequence of events. Let me just turn up the video again. Let me turn to my second story. And again, there are many things to kind of ponder on here in this example, but I want to sort of think about how speech is being used, because obviously that's one of the things that we think about with machine learning and machine intelligence. This is a video taken from a workshop that two of us attended, in which we're observing some people preparing to teach blind children various sports activities. And in this case, they're practicing an activity that they'll do with the blind children of throwing and catching. It's important to know that Warren here on the right has no central vision and very limited peripheral vision. And James is his guide, and they're going to have a go at throwing and catching. I should also say that off screen, there's another couple throwing and catching, and that's the noise that's coming from that side off screen.
So what we're going to do is we're going to find out how easy it is to send and receive a ball, and we're going to look at different ways that we can modify, we can change things to make it appropriate for the people that are in your group. So first of all, sending simply means making the ball go away from you, and receiving simply means gathering the ball in again. So that's could be a throw and a catch, or it could be a kick and a stop. It's up to you entirely. So will you just get with your partner and work out how you're going to send and receive this ball to each other?
Do you mind? That's all right. Yeah, I quite like a bit of I like things where
you
can put it. Yeah, we are. I think you should try it. I've got that in me. I like the feel of that. It's good, isn't it?
Do that.
Should we try
it? Well, try for anything.
That's
a bit
dangerous.
You want to try for a bit of spin. Here we go. Oh, you should have had that. Yeah, try again. Well, this is
all very much. And just to say that...
defeating the point.
James and Warren, who eventually throw and catch and go on to do it continuously to the point where James eventually drop kicks it and... James drop kicks it and Warren catches it. So what we might imagine to be something that a blind person would find incredibly hard to accomplish turns out to be something that they do from the second try onwards. Now, I've asked you to think about the speech that's going on there, and I'm not sure. I mean, I've watched this video again and again. This is sort of one of the things that I do as a sociologist, is really pay attention to the interactional sequences that occur in events like this. So I'm not sure if you will have noticed it, but what's happening while they're throwing and catching, and as they begin to throw and catch, and again, you may have observed this, is they don't just start throwing and catching. They just hand the ball to each other. They tap the ball in preparation, hand it to the next person, to James. Warren hands it to James. James taps it, hands it back to Warren. So there's this building up of a sequence of actions, almost in preparation for the throwing and catching. And the talk happens in synchrony with that, passing the ball. And so it's as though the talk is preparing the thrower and the catcher for what will then be, eventually, the throw and the catch. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think a lot of work is being done here, interactionally, to help Warren see. Seeing here is not a purely visual or physiological activity, it's an interactional one. The seeing that Warren does is something accomplished through the tap on the ball, through the passing of the ball in a sequence of interactions, and through language being sat on top of those activities. So when we talk about natural language processing, it's problematic to extricate it, if you will, from the activities that are unfolding. And this is an area of machine learning that I'm deeply involved in now, is sort of working with people in natural language processing to think more carefully about how we, if you like, ground the data that we have of talk. So the last story that I want to work through is a slightly longer video. It's a video from a while back in which we recorded people in cars just to better understand how domestic life extends beyond the boundaries of the home. I'm just going to play the video because it sort of speaks for itself. It's I think, a 3 or 4 minute video, so it's quite a long one, but bear with it. Whoops. This one for some reason.
Swans.
Yeah.
I wish I had a friendly dog.
A friendly dog?
Yeah, that wouldn't poo on the carpets or anywhere. Or wee on the carpets.
Yeah.
He wouldn't find his little cup where he did his poos and wees in.
I don't think dogs do that.
No, they have like...
Cats do that.
Little trays.
That's cats, not dogs.
Oh, like what do dogs do?
They go and poo outside and you have to pick it up in a plastic bag.
What if we did?
Honey, you can't even clean out the hamster. I don't think you're going to manage to clean out a dog.
I'm just saying, if.
If, yeah, that would be nice.
And in the night time when I'm asleep, it'll just come up and cuddle me. And lick me and cuddle me.
Drive you bonkers, that's what my dog used to do.
No, not lick me in the morning.
Like their dad used to send the dog in the morning to go. And you go, blah, 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 and jump all over you and you go, oh, go away. And you put the covers over your head like you do when I go in.
No, he would cuddle me and everything. Because he was really furry. Wouldn't that be nice? And just going in and out to cuddle people. Mm.
But they wouldn't. They get all excited, doggy, when they see you and they lick you. And they
try
and nibble your toes.
Yeah, but if they did... What about a puppy?
Puppies will just... Not only will they nibble and lick you, they'll probably wee all over your bed as well, so there you go. Because they wee when they get excited.
Do you remember the smallest one? He wheezed all the time, so he was called, what do you call it? In Dalmatians.
Can I have the milk, please?
In 101
Dalmatians. In a minute, let's just get
Dalmatians.
To more cows. What's he called? I thought it was called Lucky, little one.
No, that was the one that got
Puddle,
sick.
Did you call Puddle?
Yeah, he used to do wheeze all the time. And he did one on a newspaper.
Sorry, a bit late this morning.
So what I should have said is this is the school run, which you probably gathered. And they do this, Chloe and her mother do this every day. So of course they know the route. Chloe is well aware of the geography. And the sequence of events, and Chloe's timing here is perfect. That last statement, why can't we get a dog, is timed not to get an answer, because this is a war of attrition. This is something in which Chloe doesn't want the answer now. She wants to wear her mother down to the point where eventually she might just say yes. And of course it starts off with if and ends up with why can't we. And if you like, as an example of someone being entirely responsive to a context, to a spatial and temporal flow of a car moving through a city and an organization of streets, of a, if you like, a learning context, Chloe is the ultimate incarnation of intelligence here. But what I want to suggest is that it's not Chloe alone, of course. It's that car moving through a set of streets. It's Chloe's recognition and of various points along that street that builds up this ability for her to reach this crescendo of why can't we get a dog, and know that she's not going to get an answer for it yet. That the intelligence there is something that is sort of made able through Chloe's movements through space. And this is what I want us to think about when we talk about intelligence, is the conditions that are made possible through a set of interactions, through a set of interactions with between ourselves and in physical and temporal space. That we live in this sort of fantasy of imagining that we might go from something like solving Go with AI to replicating the brain, and yet what we don't really understand is what are the conditions that Go is making possible. Because they're not the same as what we would use the brain for in all possible contexts. What are the very conditions that Go enables us to do? In fact, Go is probably one of those few activities that we act more like a machine than we do like a human. So it's not surprising in a way that that AI can solve that problem and not solve Chloe's problem of talking like a human in a car. I am out of time. I was going to talk through an example of how this might be applied to natural language processing. So if anyone wants to talk more about something of that context, please come and see me later.